Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, tennis fans from around the globe. The following program is a presentation of the Yellow Ball Network. Hello, tennis fans from around the globe.
Are we on? Are we on?
Yep, we're on.
All right, let's go.
Broadcasting live from the Tennis Dynamic Studio in downtown Marietta, Georgia, this is the We Coach Tennis Radio Show on the Yellow Ball Network. Your host for the show this week is J.P. Weber.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to another edition of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. We'd love to hear from you. If you would call us, if you'd like to call us, you can call in at 646-652-4856. And normally we're on every Tuesday, but we've been skipping around. We took a break for a little while, and we're sort of still trying to catch our stride here. So we've been coming back at different times during the week, trying to get some shows put together, get some special guests. And This week is no different. We have a super, super guest. You know, the first thing that comes to mind for me when I think of this guy is he has a tagline that he uses, I think, and it's a quote from Roger Federer. And Roger Federer says, it's important to be nice. And this is one of the nicest guys I've ever met. We're going to have him on in just a few minutes. Luke Jensen is a former professional tennis player from Ludington, Michigan, played at Southern California, All-American, coached at Syracuse, played on the Pro Tour, Australian Open, French Open, Wimbledon, U.S. Open. His mother, I know her pretty well. He's got a brother, obviously. If you know tennis and you watch tennis and you're on the Tennis Channel, you've seen Murphy. His sisters are amazing. Whole family, amazing tennis family. Won the French Open champion, world champion, and this guy is one of the nicest guys that I've ever met in the business of tennis. So when we're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come right back, hopefully he'll have called in, and we will be ready to go. So let's take a commercial break, and we'll come right back.
Come play the Marietta Grand Prix. It's a lot of fun. You get to play a lot of tennis, and we have Chick-fil-A sandwiches from Chick-fil-A. And you get to eat a lot. And if you can, you can play doubles with your friends or with your dad or your mom.
Hey, folks. This is J.P. Weber. Take it from the kid. The 2015 Handmade Charlotte Marietta Grand Prix Series of Tournaments is a great way to spend the day with the family playing tennis. To find out more, go to www.tennisdynamics.net. That's tennisdynamics.net, where you can call us at the Laurel Park Tennis Center at 770-919-8602.
Hi, this is Coach Chuck Creasy. I take great pride in calling it the way it is. It's a meat and potato principle of coaching that no one really cares what you know unless they know that you care. As a parent also, I want this and very skilled hands working with my youngster. Coach J.P. Weber's 30 years of experience speaks for itself. Go see him at Laurel Park in Marietta, Georgia. His website is tennisdynamics.net. Tennisdynamics.net.
Hi, coaches and players. If you play on a tennis court in the Southeast, you've probably played on a tennis court designed, constructed, lighted, or resurfaced by courtmakers.com. Marshall Dye and the guys at Courtmakers will work on any type of court. From my experience with them, they work in a professional manner, they show up on time like they say they will, and they never leave a mess. Courtmakers can provide for all equipment needs. Call them at 770-795-8400. 770-795-8400. That's courtmakers.com. Hi, we're back here on the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. Again, if you want to call in to the show, the number for that is 646-652-4856. This wasn't supposed to be a highly publicized show, but the switchboard already lit up quite a bit. Obviously, my ratings were up. Depending more on the guest than it does, we've got a little technical difficulty there. I hope everything's good. But it rises with the guest, and we have a great guest on with us today, Luke Jensen. This guy, big guy, strong guy, amazing, looked like a football player. Now he looks like looks a lot like his dad, Howard O., but one of the nicest guys, big, mean, tough-looking guy, but one of the nicest guys you ever will meet. Luke, are you there?
I'm here, buddy. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
You got me?
I got you. Can you hear us? Everything going good? No technical difficulties?
Yeah, 10 for 10. We're good to go.
Okay, all right. And, you know, it's a testament to you. You had a long weekend. You worked pretty hard coming in, working some with your nephews, and you're on the road back. And you have this thirst for tennis, this unquenchable thirst, I believe, for tennis that is unmatched. And I think that's probably was one of your greatest strengths as a player, was it not?
I think I was very I was drawn to competition. As a kid, I played all the sports. Tennis was just one of them. To be honest, I kind of grew up using tennis to promote my footwork and agility and things like that to get myself ready for my football aspirations. And as it just turned out, the one-on-one combat that I found in tennis was just the best. I mean, team competition was fun, but it just ticked me off when I'd lose a competition, lose a game because a teammate wasn't prepared or didn't do their job, run their assignment. And tennis really fell on me. And the teamwork in doubles was just enough to still give me a little team feel for it. But what tennis really drew out of me was a sense to compete at the very highest level. And the harder I worked, the better I got. And it took me around the world.
The very toughness of the game, the competition, Bill Timm says, sometimes he says that that tennis is the most civilized form of combat. But the very toughness of it also turns people away. I was looking at something recently. Somebody came up with a stat that after one tournament, half, maybe even more down to one or two tournaments, and 75% of the people that ever played tennis quit.
Yeah, so think about the situation. In most sports, you go out there and you put your kid into soccer or football or baseball, and there's a coach who can coach while the game's going on, while you're participating. You've got an umpire that keeps score, that makes sure the rules are being maintained. In tennis, you throw some kid out there, you're not allowed to coach. So he's got to figure out the rules. He's got to call the lines. He's got to be able to play and articulate all this type of stuff. And that carries you. You're either going to be able to make it, you're tough enough to get through it, and you have the support system from your life coaches, who are your parents, whether you play tennis or whatever you do in life, your life coaches have to set the tone, have to set the standard. And then if you have really good guys, I was very fortunate to have the right coaches at the right time in my life and in my development to fuel that competitive passion. And tennis, you're going to get cheated. You're going to get situations where they change the score on you. And then you start playing internationally and they don't speak the same language. So you're going to get robbed in those situations. And it's not about winning. It's about the experience. And losing is the rocket fuel that gets you to the next level, because the amount of talent that's on the side of the road as roadkill because they just couldn't handle the losses. You have to take the losses and use it to fuel you to the next kind of next stage of your development. And every time I could specifically go to losses that got me to the next level, that rocketed me to, whether it's through juniors, through college, through the pros. And it was so helpful to be able to have a support system like my parents and like my coaches that continue to support me through those tough times.
Let me ask you just a little bit. I want to go back. Start with your you say you these coaches meant a lot to you. Start with a few of the ones that I'm familiar with that I knew about, Don Dickinson, Brian Marcus, then later Dick Leach, and some of the other ones. I guess Brian Gottfried was with you a little bit. Those guys each had areas that they were good at. Tell me a little bit, maybe Greg Patton. I remember one time you spoke with me a little bit about Greg Patton. Tell me a little bit about, let's start with each one of them. Let's start with Dickinson. You started out with Dickinson. What was his strength? What was he good at? And what made him a good coach?
Well, first, he wasn't a tennis guy. He came from basketball. He was a coach in basketball. He was extremely organized. He knew how to develop people, develop human beings, develop confidence and self-esteem in those people. And so when I was the whole thing started for me, again, starting with my football aspirations. My dad had played briefly for the New York Football Giants. My uncle played for some pro ball and things like that. So we were going to be big kids. And, you know, I could even go beyond that. But the reality was, is I was in school. I just finished the eighth grade in Ludington, Michigan. But I was the youngest in that class of the 1984 graduating class. And so as a football player, even then, my dad knew that I was going to be even too small for that class, that graduating class, if I was going to really make my mark. And I was kind of groomed and I was training to be a quarterback at Notre Dame. And so, you know, just like tennis and other sports, you have to be quick, you have to be strong, but you have to be big. And so ran into Don Dickinson, who had this, was a general manager of an indoor tennis club in Grand Rapids, which was about an hour and a half away. And I was staying out of full contact football, just skill building, learning how to throw, learning how to read defenses, even at a very young age in the eighth grade, to play the position of quarterback. And Don Dickinson took me on and boarded me up, put me up at his house with his family and kids, and taught me the game of tennis, but really the footwork and the confidence and all these things. And he taught me really what the right grips were in tennis, how to play a consistent game, and really how to manage my anger. I was a very restless, very upset kid. I used to throw my racket and go absolutely crazy. And more times than not, I didn't finish practices. We had this fun little run for punishment if you threw your racket or used bad language or you were not a good sport. And I'd go on this 2.5-mile run two or three times during a practice. And I did that a lot. So Coach Dickinson was fundamentally the building block, that cornerstone of my development. And I still look at him as a father figure to this day. I don't call him by his first name. He's Coach Dickinson or Mr. Dickinson, because I have so much respect for him and what he did in my life, not just giving me the fundamentals of tennis, but fundamentals of life.
He carried himself in a certain way, didn't he? He had a way of
carrying himself. Yeah,
he was. You weren't going to call him anything but Coach Dickinson or Don, or you, nobody's going to call him Don.
But he really presented himself that way. I mean, it was a different time. I mean, you know, today some people are players, coaches, and things like that. He was a leader and is a leader. He has always been a person that I've always admired because he ended up, running and developing this thing called the Copper Bowl, which was the largest junior tennis tournament in the world. I think, 700, 800 kids right after Winter Nationals in Tucson, Arizona, and transformed the tennis scene in Tucson and in Arizona. And it was just, he was such a real innovator, still is an innovator. And I still talk to him today and I see he and his family. And, But I think the biggest thing is he drew out the very best of what I could be. And all I had was potential. And it wasn't about tennis. Remember, I just played tennis to be a better football player because I wasn't going to play full contact until my sophomore year in high school. So I'd get bigger, stronger, wouldn't have a bad injury in contact football. And so there was a real plan my parents had in place for the football that included tennis. And then Don Dickinson kind of showed me how tennis could really take me around the world instead of playing football in my little area. I was starting to travel around in tennis tournaments in Detroit, which was 5 hours away, or Chicago. And, you know, the big moment for me was after my eighth grade. I took that eighth grade down with him, and I'm playing. I qualified for nationals out of that section, out of the Western section. Now it's the Midwest section, which was a huge accomplishment for me. I mean, my tennis was real easy. I had a wood racket and a metal racket. And that's no joke. I mean, think of the kids today who travel with all these, they've got to have three or four of the same racket in the bags and everything. I traveled with a metal racket and a wood racket. And the wood racket I bought picking corn in a field in Ludington, I bought it from the Clem brothers, played at Michigan State. The Clems, man, Steve and Mike Clem. And they played high school tennis for my dad and were really generous to let me buy one of their used Jack Kramer autographs. And I went to nationals my second year of 14s, and honestly, I was lucky to get that far, and I played this kid, Scott Carnabat, from the Southern section, who was 12 in the nation, and I remember walking on the court thinking I'm playing the number 12 player in the United States, and I looked at him, and he was this real puny-looking kid, and he was thin, and he's wiry, and I'm going, if this guy's the number 12 player in the United States, I mean, if this guy's the 12th best player, and I'm nothing. I've got a wood racket. I've got a metal racket. I mean, I'm going to dominate. You remember, I'm a football player. I'm thinking like a football player. Can I take this guy out? I mean, I remember, I can't play at all. And my number one strategy up to that point in tennis was, can I win the warm-up? If I could win the warm-up, I was trying to win the warm-up. And that means I didn't know how to warm up. I just knew I was trying to win it by hitting winners. And so I'm playing this guy, Carnabat, and I win the first game. And I'm thinking, man, I'm going to crush this guy. He's 12. He's a little scrawny guy. And then he wins 12 games in a row because I can't find the court. I find the fence. I'm hitting the scorecard. I'm hitting everything but the court because I can't keep the ball in play. But I lose 1-0, and that was one of those moments, really the first moment where I said, I want to be the number one player in the world. This guy's number 12, and I can take him out. I'm one of the better athletes. I'm looking around. I'm bigger, stronger, faster than these guys. And when I go to football camp, and I'm going to Notre Dame, and I'm going to University of Michigan football camps, I'm just one of the little guys. But in tennis, I was one of the big guys. And I was like, I could actually do something in this game. And I remember calling home and saying, you know, no more football. I want to be the number one player in the world in tennis. And I don't think my dad talked to me for a while after that. But that's when Don Dickinson really took hold of me and turned me into a champion.
So then Brian Marcus entered.
Yeah, so what happened was that, so I played another year with Coach Dickinson, and Coach then took his academy at that time out to Arizona. It was just tough to have an academy in those years indoors. The expenses were high, and it was really growing. And but I was just so tight with my family, still am today, and we ended up not going to Arizona. And that was kind of a blessing in disguise because I kind of went to this guy, Brian Marcus, who's still in the Atlanta area, ended up being a director of tennis at the Atlanta Athletic Club. But during those early years for me, I was a sophomore in high school, he taught what I call the Kramer big game. The Jack Kramer big game is really when serve and volley came into its own. And Kramer was a very smart tennis player. A lot of people know the tennis racket and how great and influential he was in the game of tennis. But he developed the serve and volley tactic, which was really, as a right-hander, you serve wide and then you volley wide. You really put a lot of pressure on your opponent that way. And that's how the kind of serve and volley got popular. Well, Brian Marcus was a University of Michigan baller, varsity player, played some pro circuit stuff, but was a guy who took a kid who was a sophomore, 16 years old, and Luke Jensen, and who was real consistent, very good athlete, but taught him the big game. So now for the first 3 or 4 months, that first semester going into my of my sophomore year in high school, I serve and volleyed first and second serve. Now, up to this point, Don Dickinson had taught me how to serve with my opposite hand. So I was serving big, right-handed and left-handed. And I was nasty indoors. And that moment was huge because Marcus taught me really what it was like to be a professional, play a complete game, and play what I call tomorrow's game. What was I going to be like, not at 16 years old, but at 18, 19, and 25? And that's when really I separated once again from the pack. So I went from a player who was 90-some in the nation. I think I was 94 my second year of 14s with my one wood racket, my one metal racket. Put a Prince Graphite in my hand. And now I'm 6'2", about a buck 80, and I'm just serving bombs, left-handed, right-handed. And then I jumped first year 16s to 42. And then, you know, tomorrow's game really took hold. First year 18s, I ended up 7th in the nation and playing U.S. Open juniors, getting to play against Connors and McEnroe and these guys. And then second year 18s, I got to number one. And that was really a culmination of Don Dickinson, Brian Marcus, showing me really the fundamentals and the big game.
Then you go to college, you run into Dick Leach. What made Dick Leach, what was it about Dick Leach that made him such a good coach?
So the biggest thing there, I was very fortunate. So in the mid-'80s, Arthur Ashe was the Davis Cup captain. And I had a lot of success in juniors, but I was starting to have some success as a pro. I'd reached the second round of the U.S. Open main draw, the men's open. I got a wild card from the USGA. It was very, very good to me and our family, and gave us a wild card main draw. And then 2 years in a row, I got into the main draw, won a round each year. And I was rocking. I was looking, maybe should I turn pro? I had this serving on both sides. I kind of had a lot of momentum and force going behind me. And Arthur Ashe sat me down, and I thought I was going to be picked to go play a tie against Japan. Aaron Krikstein was, you know, one of the top players. He was a Michigan kid, and American tennis was rocking. Connors was still in the mix, and this was before Agassi and Sampras and those guys. And you had McEnroe, obviously, Johnny Mac. And he sat me down. Instead of talking to me about a tie representing the United States on the Davis Cup team, he said, you know, I went to college. Johnny Mack went to college. Connors went to college. All these guys I idolized, Stan Smith, Dennis Ralston. I mean, I idolized these legends. Billie Jean King went to college, and he was naming all these great players. He said, you know, what? I think I was 268 on the ATP at the time, and I'm an amateur still. And just, I have so much confidence. And he said, how much does number 268 in the world make? I had no idea. He goes, when you turn pro, you pay for everything. You pay for your rent. You pay for your airfare. Right now, the USGA is picking up everything because you're on the Junior Davis Cup team. He said, you need to go to college, and you need to grow up. And it was like, whoa, I need to grow up. And he said, you can still be pros. Like, you know, all these guys end up being professional tennis players. But right now, I think the best thing for you to do is go to college. And based on that conversation, I started looking at schools, and in my mind, all I wanted to do was be the number one player in the world. That's all my vision was. That was my mission in life, and college was just another step, like junior tennis was a step of getting there. So when I went on my recruiting visits, I went to SMU and Dennis Ralston. I went to Pepperdine and Alan Fox and all these great programs, and they all told me about how much fun I was going to have in college. I went to Chuck Creasy at Clemson. And they were showing me all the things that we were going to accomplish in college. But Coach Leach showed me one thing that connected to me. We have 4 plaques at Mark Stadium at University of Southern California. One's from the Australian Open, one's from the French Open, one's from the Wimbledon Championships, and one's from the U.S. Open. And on those plaques are all the champions who had played at USC and had won Grand Slams. And Coach Sleet said, I can show you all the things about USC, but you're going to come here and I'm going to teach you how to win a Grand Slam. And I've never, no coach had said that. They were talking about they'll improve my game, they'll make me bigger, stronger, faster, they'll prepare me for the pros. But this guy was saying, he's going to coach me. He's going to teach me how to win a Grand Slam. Well, that's all I needed to hear. You know, and of course, beating Marcus Allen, O.J. Simpson, and all these Heisman Trophy winners as a football guy, I was all in, man. He was telling me what I wanted to hear. And so I had great teammates in Rick Leach and Jorge Lozano, who ended up winning Grand Slams. I mean, it was a breeding ground of excellence. And Coach Leach, from day one, was always extremely upfront and honest and a father figure that Don Dickinson and Brian Marcus was to me. And if I got upset, he kicked me out of practice. But he always gave me a big hug when I came back, was always working on that game. And as a tactician, this guy, Coach Leach, was a genius, is a genius. He would get in the matches with me and show me how to articulate my left-handed, right-handed serves, what it meant to be a full-court player, an all-court player, under pressure when you're playing against the Stanford Cardinal, the Commies of UCLA, and everybody we played. And so for 2 years, I feel I was kind of, if you follow football, Bill Walsh, who, you know, developed the West Coast offense, is considered a genius of football coaches. Well, Dick Leach was that for my game. Taught me how to use the complete court, taught me how to play doubles, true doubles, the big man's game. I mean, in your face, taught me really what it was like to be on a team rather than being an individual. And when I launched into the pros after my sophomore year, I was thoroughly prepared to make my move in the pros. It took me a while to get there, but I was fundamentally set because of his teachings.
What was so? If you had, then you had. I think you mentioned one time Greg Patton was a super influence on you.
Well, I mean, he's. Yeah, you know, Coach Patton, I mean, when you think, I'm telling you about Arthur Ashe, Brian Gottfried is in the mix. If you know Ola Malmquist, who's big with the USTA right now, he traveled with me in the satellites and was a huge mentor to me. He had won the NC2A doubles, and we were playing on the circuit, and he took me under his wing. They're just Dick Stockton, Dennis Ralston, Billie Jean King worked with me, Jimmy Connors. Jimmy Connors, during an off day at the U.S. Open, takes me out, beats me 6-0 on an outside court. And he used to wear these rubberized suits. And he took this rubber, after beating me 6-0, just smoked me. He was notorious for short but very intense practices. He didn't mess around. He beat me so bad, and he never called me by my first name. He just called me son. He goes, son, how do you think I judge my practices? I don't know, Mr. Connors. I have no idea. And, of course, you know, during the U.S. Open, there are people all around. It's Jimmy Connors. And he takes off this rubberized, like top, and then he's got his T-shirt, and it's soaking wet. And he says, I judge my practices based on the size of the puddle of sweat I leave behind. So he takes out this shirt, and he starts wringing out this shirt, and this puddle gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And he goes, it's a pretty good practice. Not a good practice. Pretty good practice. I could watch that guy practice, play matches, just a warrior. But he practiced with the same intensity that he competed with. The competitor that you saw, Jimmy Connors, it was the same heartbeat from the practice session. He beat me 6-0, and he thoroughly whipped my tail. But that's how he was able to translate that. A lot of people are just practice players, and they can't translate because they can't match the intensity that you need to be at your very best. And he was a great mentor to me. So I could go on and on. Martina Navratilova, Chris Evert took me under her wing and showed me how to focus and prepare and how serious you know, big time tennis was. So I had tons of mentors and big brothers and sisters and father figures and mother figures, you know, that really helped me in the game, that were always there. Jimmy Arias was a huge factor for me, gave me what I call the Jimmy forehand, which I lost my forehand for about 5 years when I went into college because I was trying to overanalyze my game. I was trying to work too much on technique when I had all the fundamentals down, and I kind of lost it for 5 years. And one afternoon during a rain delay, and we're playing a tournament in Nice, and he's looking at me, and I was in the doubles and stuff, but I was just fighting for my meal money, just trying to get a win here and there. And he looked at me and said, "Man, what happened to you? You were the number one junior in the world, and now you can't play." I go, "Yeah, man, I got a forehand that plays like a butcher. I can't, you know," everybody knew it. You can tell everybody your weaknesses because on the circuit, everybody knows. They watch your practices. They watch your matches. They know it because on the circuit, money does matter. You're trying to take somebody's meal money. And so everybody knows your weaknesses. They know your strengths and tendency. And so he said, "You know, why don't we go out?" It was raining. And we go out. And he goes, "I remember we used to practice all the time." He goes, "Why just flip it back to the western, as far western as you can go, and rip it as hard as you can with as much topspin as you can?" And all of a sudden, like, the thing came back in the very first swing. It was unbelievable. 5 years of my life just gone, just playing with a meat hook of a forehand. So I was trying to hit it too flat, and it just wasn't my stroke. And all of a sudden, I win Monte Carlo in doubles the next week, and I go on a tear, and my career was back and back on track. And that's how Murphy and I were able to, you know, really torch up the tour for a little bit when we played in the mid-90s.
You know, it's interesting. You know, I talked to your mother a couple of times, and you were always, you were very much going to do exactly what any coach told you. And something kind of occurs to me. Do you think, I have a saying about, I kind of believe in a singular voice. I don't like a lot of voices in a kid's head. And you got a lot of people out there trying to help you because, you know, everybody, I'm sure everybody was out there trying to help you as much as possible. But as many different voices as you had, did that hurt on some level? Or do you
to
think,
be honest,
do you think
so,
50 different voices is okay?
I think there, you're always having to have an open mind, because you may not need it right now, but something. Tony Traber, another mentor, T2, man. Tony Traber just taught me, again, how to hit a drop shot. Now, I mean, it's just little things like that. Now, I didn't understand the philosophy at the time. I wasn't old enough or mature enough. I wasn't ready for the knowledge, but I still took it. I was notorious for writing down notes. I have journals that go back to the sixth grade of my life, when a sixth grade teacher had us do a journal project and keep a diary. And I kept it for all these years and wrote in it again tonight. And so I was notorious for writing down notes, and I'll go back to those notes. And I always felt, you know, I was told to be a student of the game. And so I think when you have a lot of opportunities to learn from different coaches, it may not click into your game plan right now, but maybe down the road. And so you're just gathering all this knowledge. And my pathway was about coaches at the right time of my development. And where I got in trouble with my forehand was I wasn't overcoached. I was just, I remember the conversation like it was today. Sitting down with Brian Godfrey, I just lost in the second round of the U.S. Open to Brad Gilbert on court 16. And I'm heading out to Southern Cal the very next day, and Brian Godfrey, is telling me, you know, just, you know, this is the match and these are the stats, and, you know, you had a good run and everything, good first round, and we'll build on this. And I said, "Brian, what do I need to do to get better? I will do anything to get better." It was me asking him, and all kids should be very, you know, it's good. I wanted more information. I wanted, you know, anything. And Brian was like, "You know, your forehand's landing a little short. I think maybe if you change the grip, go over a little easter, just go back instead of so severe western." And that's all it was. It was just a suggestion. It wasn't like, we got to revamp, we got to do this and that and all these things. And then he still lives in Florida, and I was going out to L.A. So all of a sudden, that little hint, and I took it to Coach Leach, and Coach Leach had, you know, seven other kids he's working with. So, you know, if you've played college tennis, you know, it's a real team aspect. It's hard to get that individual attention. And I think if Brian was with me when I was working on this thing, he would have seen that this was a really a bad idea on that side of my game, that forehand. And so I just kept trying. I was so determined to make that thing work that I couldn't find my natural forehand until 5 years later. Jimmy Arias just honestly gave me a lightning bolt of an idea to just keep it simple and rip the garbage out of it. And it just worked. That was my forehand. It still is today. You're not going to, you know, it's not a Roger Federer type. It's not a work of art. It's a functioning forehand that I can play when the money's on the line. And I got too ambitious to try to tweak every little thing, every little technical thing, every little this and that, when I was just a baller. I had my strokes down. I was well on my way to doing some special things. But I just got distracted by trying to do a little too much and got away from my game.
If you could pick out from, you mentioned quite a bit, some of the names, many of those names are in the Hall of Fame, Tennis Hall of Fame. If you could pick out, in various Hall of Fames, but if you could pick out the common denominator, or is there a couple of common denominators among all these coaches that made them good coaches?
They cared. They cared deeply, and they were all extremely proud of their philosophy and their approach. They had their own. There were similarities in the way they approached work ethic. You'll never find a coach worth his or her salt that says, listen, you don't have to put in 100%. Just, you know, listen, save it for here, save it for there. You want to be smart. But every single coach that I worked with or listened to, whether they were, people who achieved greatness and really produced a lot of players, there's always that common work ethic. They were working as hard. They cared as much as the player did. And they believe. This was amazing. I really want to take you back to Dickinson, because if this conversation doesn't happen, there's no way I make it. And when I decided I wanted to be number one in the world, I really want to be clear to everyone out there. I was the number two player ranked in Northern Michigan out of two players. And the number one player was Chris Caldwell. And the Goose, he used to The Goose would double bagel me on a daily basis. And he enjoyed giving me those bagels. And he liked lox on those bagels. And he liked them toasted. He wanted cream cheese on those bagels. So when I'm going into Coach Dickinson and I'm saying, Coach Dickinson, I want to be number one in the world. Now, he could have said, you know, it's maybe not in the cards for you. You're here to play football, to get your footwork in. And in a couple of years, you're going to start playing contact football. That's what you're going to do. He could have said that. Instead, from Dickinson on, every coach took my aspirations and my dreams and said, you can do it. You apply yourself, you put the wood to it, and you get after it. Now, you got to be the hardest worker out there. Like when we do that little lap around the court, you better not be second. You better be first, because everything's a competition when you're trying to be number one in the world. Everything counts. The stretch, you got to be the best person in the stretcher. You got to be the first to practice. You got to be the last to leave. You got to do all these things. Do you know your equipment? What's your racket strung at? Well, I don't know. Well, you better know, because your competition, Goose, he knows. He's beating you 0-0. So to me, the coaching, the threat of all these guys, from, you know, Coach Creasy working with me in the summertime, getting me to puke on sprints and running hills. That number one, they're compassionate, they cared, and they showed you the work ethic. If it really meant something to you, they're going to gravitate you, because every coach wants to work with a worker.
Let me take and before I say that, let me say that there's probably no doubt in my mind that with you, the way you were a coach giving you, I don't care if you were number two in Northern, in the Intermountain section or someplace like that, back then the Western section, but giving you with your, you know, athleticism and your work ethic and the way you were, they probably knew that it wasn't a complete and total stretch with you. They didn't have to be too much of a fortune teller.
They knew something
was there.
JP, we'll sit down and watch some home movies. And I'm telling you, I found everything but the court. We used to play tournaments, we used to play like 10 and under, 12 and under tournaments at Kalamazoo where the Nationals are playing. Now, I want to be very specific here. I wasn't playing the Nationals at that point. I was playing like the 10 and under Kalamazoo Open. And I would hit, if you've ever been to Kalamazoo, it's really cool. The stands are up high and the courts are kind of sunken in. And I used to hit people because I'd shank the ball. I had no concept of consistency. I thought the harder you hit, the better you would get. And Coach Dickinson, one of the biggest moments in my life where I played a match and I was hitting the back fence more than I was hitting the court. And he just said, this is the day. This is the day I'm going to make you a player. And we have this famous, you probably know this drill, the 25 ball drill. And Coach Dickinson, for a guy who came from basketball, he had a great forehand. And he'd corner in that forehand corner, and I'd have to get 25 balls in a row. And this was before my Western forehand. I was a plumber. And we went right from the tournament, and we go straight to the practice court. And if I missed two in a row, I'd take a lap. And if I got upset, I'd go run for 2.5 miles. And I was in tears, and I'm crying. And I just – and he's saying, listen, we either get this down or you go home. It's as simple as that. I mean, home meaning – it's 2 hours back to Ludington, and that was it. That was going to be the end of my tennis career. And our motto in the Jensen family is Jensen's never quit. So I wasn't going to quit. I was going to cry a lot. I was going to run a lot. Going to get really frustrated. And he used to tee off on that forehand, so you couldn't push it. And he'd junk ball you, and he'd talk trash and talk junk and try to get in your head and would get in your head.
He took that probably from somewhere in basketball. But now talk about this just a second, because that was, and for me, I still use it some, that was an unmerciful drill. He was going to kill you.
Yeah.
You were either going to go through him, and he put himself up there as an obstacle to you. And you mentioned something to me this past weekend. You know, Creasy, that was his success at Clemson to a degree, correct? I mean, he kind of had to do that. Is that, I mean, he, so you know, we talk about common denominators, these guys. Did you see, let me
his
ask you
rosters,
this.
Yeah.
Well, did a Leach ever get into that area? Did a Leach ever go there? Because I could see Don Dickinson going into that realm, and that's a realm that, you know, Creasy could be in, where they were putting themselves in between you and your goal. You know what I mean? They made themselves kind of the person you had to get overcome in a way. Did a Leach ever do that, or was a Leach, did you see that at all in any other coaches?
No. Remember now, again, it goes back to the rosters. And really, if you look at Coach Creasy's rosters, he took some tough, rough diamonds in the rough. And that's being generous. Outside of, like, honestly, like Jay Berger, the rest of those guys from Mark Dixon and Matuszewski and, you know, the Kent Kinnears of the world, those guys were average at best.
Don't forget Lawson.
Lawson Duncan. Now, that guy, he chews nails and eats, you know, broken glass for breakfast. But that's the kind of guy he made better. Everybody got better. If you're able to survive Creasy, you were going to make it. You were going to get better. You couldn't help it. Now, remember, Coach Leach, I was the number one player in my age group. Rick Leach was the number one player in his age group. You know, you had Jorge Lozano, who was playing Davis Cup for Mexico. He's coming back after playing Johnny Mack in Davis Cup. So, you know, you didn't have to worry about the talent. It was already percolating. You had to make it better through tactical execution, just being honestly more of a real good, smart, talented evaluator, just like Dick Gould and these guys. You got to wind these guys up. It's a different cat when you're dealing with number one compared to, you know, Joe Average, who's losing Triple Crown at the Nationals. And Creasy took that and made it awesome. Coach Leach didn't need that approach. He had just too much talent all over the place. So Coach Leach never raised his voice. Coach Leach was very X's and O's. And I don't say Coach Creasy wasn't. But you couldn't give X's and O's. And JP, I just got out of something up at Syracuse University where I wasn't getting these blue chips either. I was getting kids who were playing high school tennis. And so it's a different approach altogether when you have to make up so much ground and so much work, I mean so much road, just to get them to keep the ball in play, to get them to believe in themselves. Because when you get kids who are 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 200 in the nation, they're losing more than they're winning. But if you go to USC, you go to Stanford, they're winning a lot more than they're losing. It's a different cat when you get them to college.
I want to take a quick commercial break. Change is happening in the whole world exponentially. Change is happening in tennis. I want to take a commercial break, come back, and then I got several callers on here, it looks like. I want to talk about your prescription for change or your prescription for success for college, the pros, and the juniors. Can you stay with us?
You got it, buddy.
All right. Let me take a quick break, and we'll be right back. I can't think of a better place to go than Courtmakers.com for any of my court equipment needs. Any kind of equipment that you need for your club or facility. Windscreens, nets, net straps, benches, scoreboards. You can find all of this at Courtmakers.com. Or like them on Facebook and see all the latest stuff that they're doing in court construction, resurfacing, and lighting. That's Courtmakers.com, Courtmakers.com.
Hi, this is Coach Chuck Creasy. All of you know that I take pride in calling it the way it is. And boy, oh boy, is it an exciting time in tennis. The 10 and under stuff, the juniors, the pros, and college. If you want to hear the cutting edge of the real stuff and not just the diluted and watered down fluff, folks, listen to Coach J.P. Weber on the We Coach Tennis program every Tuesday at noon Eastern Standard Time here on the Yellow Ball Network.
Okay, I'm here. We're back of the We Coach Tennis Radio Show, and I'm actually here, and Brio, my dog, is here, and he's letting everybody know he's here as well. We're talking to Luke Jensen. If you want to call in to the We Coach Tennis Radio Show, the call-in number is 646-652-4856. And Luke, for the vast amount of time that we've been on Earth, it was easy to assume that in the world, you know, what you and I were born into at the end of the, or what maybe what your dad was born into, with the world your dad was born into and the world your dad just recently passed away, it didn't change a great deal. In the next 100 years, change is going to be like 20,000 years for over 100 years. It's not going to be 100 years. It's going to be 20,000 years. Tennis is changing. I hear about it all the time. One of the biggest changes, it's pushing things, and one of the biggest impetuses for change is television, whether it's professional tennis, whether it's collegiate tennis. Television is really pushing a lot, but television, Luke, to me, doesn't have any loyalty to tennis. Once television doesn't have any need for tennis anymore and it's done with it, you know, they may not deal with it anymore. So I'm kind of curious, you know, what is your take on this, and what's your prescription? Let's start with pro tennis. If you're looking at pro tennis, television says, and you know, Johan Kriek, I think, was on my show a year or so ago, and he said, "Look, 3 out of 5 sets is just too much. can't do 3 out of 5 sets anymore. It's ridiculous. It's the best we need to do is 2 out of 3. What's your thought on that?
I know we talked about this, and you're teeing me up. The great thing is we can have these discussions. And I love the history of our game. I'm so proud to have been a part of the game of tennis, being an American tennis player, playing internationally. But the reality is, and I've worked, for a long time with ESPN and getting to know that side of it, the reality is that we're in a different ball game now that people, whether they're the young people or the baby boomers, we have so many options for our time and our dime. That's the reality of it. And we can track at ESPN at any, you're watching football or whatever you're watching, the people that are, trying to sell advertising and all this stuff, they're looking for something that's attractive, something that's fun, something that grabs the viewer, that keeps them glued to those commercials. Because TV pays for that prize money. TV pays for everything. So if we can track at ESPN when the people follow a best-of-3-set match and follow a best-of-5-set match. And it's kind of all over the place. And they'll stay for the first set, and they'll go away until middle of the second. They'll see where it's going. And if Roger's up a set and a break, they leave. They're done. And then they'll bounce back if it gets close. And so, but if you watch a best-of-3-set match, if Serena's playing or Venus or a star, the audience stays to that at the Grand Slam. And the reality is we have 4 Super Bowls in our game. 4 Super Bowls at the Australian, at the French, Wimbledon, and the U.S. Open. These are awesome for the game of tennis. And the TV game will always be attracted to those 4 Super Bowls. And there will always be stars manufactured, the next star, the next Roger, the next Rafa, the next Johnny Mac, the next Sharapova. Someone's going to burst out and start taking these things over in the next 5, 10, 20 years. Hopefully, for our sake, it will be an American. And if it's an American, that is great for us. That means more ratings, more revenue, more opportunities for our USTA kids, and more interest. When I was playing in the mid-90s, we had the greatest generation of all time, Agassi, Sampras, Courier, Chang, and then the supporting cast of, Todd Martin and Mel Washington and all these other guys. And so it was gangbusters for us. And that was with Johnny Mac still hanging around. Jimmy Connors was kind of floating here and there, early 90s. So to me, if you go to best-of-3 sets, you're going to get the audience glued to more of your action. Now, I understand the classic 5-setters, but again, I'm an extremist. I want to see no ad scoring. I want to see players play instead of 2 out of 3 sets, 2 events. I'm sorry, I want to see players playing 2 out of 3 sets, but play 2 events of the 3, play doubles and singles, or singles and mixed doubles, to keep our stars in. That would, in my opinion, be amazing. But players are getting injured more often. You're asking the male players on the ATP Tour to play 2 out of 3 sets the entire tour except the 4 majors, our 4 Super Bowls, and then you tell them to change the length of the race to best-of-5. That's why I think guys are getting hurt. Roy Emerson told me, I think he was talking to a bunch of us, he used to practice 6 sets a day preparing for Grand Slams. He used to practice 6 sets, not 3, not 5. He'd play 6 sets because he knew that prepared him for 5. Guys don't do that. And I think that's why guys are getting injured. And I think, to me, that's why the ratings go up and down on the men's side, because it's hard to watch. I know you're hardcore. JP, I know you love watching those 5-setters. But the reality is, for the good of the game, I believe you've got to go to 2 out of 3 sets.
College tennis, what's your prescription there?
College tennis is in a very interesting state right now. I loved playing in it. I loved coaching it. It was just some of the best times of my life. My time at USC, where Coach Leach talked about, when you go to USC, you're going to be part of our family for the rest of your life. I talked to one of my teammates just tonight, Scotty Melville. And he was on my 87 team, and he was on Murphy's teams at Southern Cal, and saw Rick Leach. It really has been an opportunity of a lifetime to really expand my tennis family, and it's awesome. But college tennis now has got to really do radical changes, in my opinion. And it's not necessarily the scoring system. But to me, fundamentally, if you want it to be a TV product, you can't have six balls in the air at the same time. I covered it for ESPN, the Nationals, the NCAAs. I've done numerous TV events for college. But trying to get six courts with cameras, it doesn't do it justice. The amount of editing you have to do to put it into a one-hour package, it doesn't do it justice. If they want to be smart, you want to make college tennis like World Team Tennis. Co-gender, five sets, it's over in 3 hours, and you can get one court with one ball and get some true excitement out there. It's too complicated right now to try to put it on TV, and that's why it really struggles. It's not a talent issue. It's how you communicate the product to the fan. And the people watching at home, it's too difficult, especially with the weird scoring, short sets, and this and that. It's, to me, I know you're not a big no-ad guy. I'm a massive no-ad guy. The more pressure, the better. The more drama, the better. And I just think it's – I don't think it will happen, in my opinion, because you're going to eliminate – half the coaches on these schools. But we're losing college tennis programs, and it's sad. But the reality is that for it to work, for you to make it good for TV, you've got to make it one court, one ball in the air, not six matches going on at the same time.
Junior tennis, what would you do? You know, I see nowadays something happening where, and I think it would just make it worse, the idea of going to World Team Tennis. But I see now boys 18 draws in the most common tournaments that we have in the South. We have the level 5s and level 4s. We have hundreds of those. You can't get the 18s to fill in the boys. It's like back when I was a kid when you couldn't get the girls to fill. Still, you really actually don't even get the girls to fill still. They still, with all the gender equity, with all the emphasis that we put on it, you still can't get girls' draws to make. I can go back and show you sometime if you want to look at it. Our draws over the years, we've been doing just umpteen dozen tournaments at our park, and when you look at them, the girls' draws never fill. But now, you know, in those 5 years, I've seen too this new thing. The boys' draws don't fill. So what do you say? Are you a big fan of the ROG? Are you a big fan of making that one-day tournaments? What do you think it needs to happen?
Anytime we can compete, that's great. I'd love to be able to track where these kids end up. Obviously, see the big draws of the 14s, the 12s, and get their information, kind of track and ask them, why aren't you playing? What is really going on here? To me, it reads out burnout. To me, they call it homeschool. I call it no school. No school is, you know, a situation where, you know, kids, you know, are playing more tennis than they should, and they're playing more tournaments than they should, and so they're getting burned out when they're 16, 18. Again, but that's just my personal opinion. I do have the facts when I was coaching at Syracuse where the homeschool kids had great GPAs, but they had the worst SAT scores or ACT scores than the normal brick-and-mortar school or the normal public school kids who didn't do the homeschool thing. So to me, there's a burnout issue. But the one thing that concerns me, JP, is that there is a character crisis within our kids, a character crisis. There's a confidence crisis with our kids. What has had our motivational crisis? Why are they burning out so much? Why are they playing so much? I mean, and what truly is their vision and mission? Because I see your son, I see my nieces and my nephews. They love the game. Where does that go? And to me, it's making sure as parents and as coaches, we keep the perspective of their game of tomorrow, who they're going to be tomorrow, and instilling self-esteem, instilling values, instilling core mission for what they want to be in life, not just a tennis player. What do you want to do outside of tennis? How are you balancing your life instead of balancing a tennis ball or hitting a tennis ball? And that's great. To me, I am so proud that our family, four of us, made it on the pro circuit, on the pro tour. And in 1996, all four children, Rachel, Rebecca, Murphy, and I, competed in the main draw of the 96 Australian Open. That's my proudest accomplishment because it was our family coming from an 8,000, you know, populated town with no indoor courts in northern Michigan. And it was just a culmination of a lot of blood, sweat, tears, and miles driven, sacrifices made. And to this day, we love the game. There isn't one person in our family that isn't truly in debt to the game and in debt to the people who helped us get there and sacrificed and gave us so many opportunities to get us there and housed us and fed us. And to me, that's what I'm concerned about in junior tennis. Why are these draws not filled? Why are they stopping at the time when they should be playing more? And that, to me, is the character crisis. Why is there so much cheating? Why is there so much pressure? I play because I just love to compete. I coach because I want to instill the values that I was given at that age. Whether they win the point, lose the point, it's all relative. What did you learn through tennis? And it's a great game. And I hate to see kids get burned out because they no longer have the emotional fuel it takes to continue to practice, to play, and to sacrifice.
Let's grab a couple of callers. Let me see if I can grab one. I've got one here, 479. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Who we got, caller?
Yes, I'm here. Yes, I'm here.
I'm sorry?
I'm here.
Okay. Okay, hey, caller, have you been listening to Coach Jensen, Coach Luke Jensen on the line here? Have you been listening to his talk?
I've been listening on and off, JP. My wife talked to me about a couple of things, and I kind of lost a little bit, but I kind of got the hang of the conversation.
Did you catch any of his prescription? What do you think about his prescription? Luke's going to go
Luke is gonna make sense of, and I think he's gonna ring some bells for you also. You know, for non-tennis players and people who have not played these games long enough, then don't understand tennis that well. You know, I come from an all tennis player family also. Actually, I'm like the third generation, and in my family, you know, every decision that's taken and we make, whether it's tennis related or not, is based on stuff that's linked to tennis one way or another. You know, it's hard to people to understand that you can use tennis as a reference for anything and everything because tennis teaches you about life. And just listening to Luke, you know, about his Northern Michigan raising of his family and all that around tennis and the sacrifices they made and all that, it's really awesome stuff. If we could get people to understand and sell the idea that, look, through tennis, you're going to learn about life and you're going to forge a better living, whether you make it to the pros or just play through high school or whatever, I think that would be a good sell point to parents and families, you know. That is my two.
I love that. I love that. That's exactly the message. Yeah, enriching lives through the beautiful game of tennis and all these great stories, these family stories. And it's just so enlightening to hear and inspiring to hear people that have these stories, these family stories.
Thank you. That was Manuel Cervantes from Arkansas. He's originally from Mexico. Manuel, can you think of any other question you might have for Luke?
Luke, he was here about a month ago at our charity challenge. Yeah, we got to chat a little bit about junior tennis.
Manuel loves to serve in volley, my friend. He's got a rock star His daughter can ball, baby. You better watch out.
Yep.
He's got a daughter that can play. Yep.
She's coming up, huh? She's coming up. Let me grab another caller here. Caller at 864. Caller 710-864-710. Hello?
Yeah, hey, JP.
Coach Creasy, how you doing?
Oh,
hey,
the legend.
The legend.
Hey, Luke.
It's almost the Coach Creasy show. We've got commercials with Coach on there.
I was trying to keep my hand in somehow, you know, guys. It's pretty good. But
you got a good thing, Coach.
Talk about an unquenchable thirst, you two guys together. Jeez. Unquenchable.
The biggest thing, Coach, that sticks out. Go ahead.
We've been talking. Now, I'm sure. Were you able to hear Luke on some of the
thing.
Okay. All right. Let me bring up one thing, Luke. Luke, you mentioned earlier in the show, and I remember this because I remember you played on, I think, cow dung court somewhere in India on a backcourt, no official.
Yeah.
You're playing ad scoring. Look, the guys that originated scoring in tennis, they had that ad in there for a reason, because it was really hard to cheat somebody twice. You might be able to cheat them once, but across the board, I don't think you've probably ever run into too many. You know, you think the cheating's bad now. I mean, you're out on those cow dung courts back when you're young and you had no official. What do you do when some guy cheats you and it's a no ad point? I mean, I think one of the originators of our system of scoring would say, geez, that ad in there kind of that helps add the benefit of doubt to the whole thing. No?
Is it for
you? Yeah. It's for you, Luke. Well, it's a comment for you, and then I'm assuming that Coach Creasy, you've heard his show enough. I want to hear, but just on that, the cheating alone, you know, the benefit of doubt, you know, that goes out the door, doesn't it, with no ad? Doesn't that go out the door with no
ad?
Well,
I mean, obviously, that can obviously happen. It has happened and all those things. But to me, again, I'm looking more at the professional level where pressure is good, keeps eyeballs on the TV screens. And it really is. If you want more money in the game, more curiosity, more interest, you got to put more pressure on it. That's just in my view.
Coach?
I wanted to first say that a couple things that stick out, just really like nose on the face, Luke, your passion, and coming up from Ludington, Michigan. I wanted to point out one huge thing. The key thing with the Jensens all getting good is I don't think they knew how hard it was going to be. In other words, there's a saying in coaching that you keep fog on top of the mountain until kids are too high up to turn back. In other words, nowadays with the computers, with the cell phones, with the kids can sort of size up how much pain, how much gain, and how much time is it going to take me to do it. And the point being is that it's not that they get burned out. One time, Luke, I had a youngster parent saying, I don't want my son to get burned out. I said, sir, with all due respect, and you've got to have a little fire burning in the belly before you can burn out, you know? I don't think the Jensens ever burned out because they kept their eyes on the prize, and they didn't know how hard it was. That was a big, big thing. I think that you guys need to write a book about how you did it, because we need a lot of dreams to be carried out that way. But
hey, but Coach, here's the thing. Thank you so much for those really nice comments. But this is what – I don't know if you found this coaching the modern junior and collegiate player now, but I'll never forget when phone – so I started in 2006. And the phones were just starting with the student-athlete. And I had to start taking phones away. And what I found was we'd go for a weekend invitational. When I was playing, we didn't have access immediately to phones. So I didn't find out what the party scene was like. What my buddies were doing you know, chasing girls until I got back Sunday night. I may call them on the landline or something, but
yeah.
Nowadays I find that whether it's a junior player or a collegiate player, they know what they're missing out on. If I took them to an invitational, if we went to a tournament, they knew on Friday, man, they're missing it. You see the pictures, they see the video, and they're stuck in some hotel, you know, Hampton Inn somewhere, you know, at the free breakfast in the morning. They lost the enthusiasm because they felt they were missing out on all this fun collegiate stuff or junior stuff. And that's why I think we miss, you know, those drawn to 18.
The old saying in coaching is the taste of beer and the smell of a woman's hair ruin many a great career before it ever gets off the ground. And, you know, people, my children homeschool now, and, you know, people will say, oh, gosh, you're missing out on the socialization. Oh, I say, oh, my gosh, they're going to miss out on the sex and the drugs. Oh, my gosh, are you kidding me? You know,
right.
You know, and the thing is, there's nothing better than homeschool when it's done right. There's probably nothing worse when it's done wrong. But, you know, listen, let me make a couple quick comments. You know, Luke, what he says is not, it's not all wrong, it's not all right, it's just like anything. The differentiation has to be made between entertainment and education. And I couldn't care less what they do for the entertainment of the game if they got to do an entertainment dollar, where my whole emphasis is in fighting this, fighting to preserve our 132-year heritage of our wonderful, wonderful game and the most fantastic scoring system we have is the educational aspect of it. We have chess that we're making into checkers. And believe me, Luke, I know because as you played it, I coached it for 15 years, and I saw many a good career not prosper. But I wanted to make that point that it is the difference. I don't care what they do about the entertainment part of it, but now that NOAAD is being pushed down into junior tennis, it's pushed into college tennis, our kids don't fall in love with it because you mentioned drama, but there is no drama. NOAAD takes drama out of it. I sat up and watched both of the 13-inning games in the baseball a couple weeks ago because of the tremendous drama at the late part of a baseball game. And nobody staying up till 2 a.m. complained about the length of those ball games. You know, but the drama is – drama always makes excitement. Excitement doesn't make drama. But I understand what you're saying about the entertainment part of it. But here I wanted to make this point. And the point JP makes is the most superficial part of it, but it's the most obvious. It's the cheating that takes place because one point is a deciding point, it's worth two games. Everybody recognizes that at 4-2, it could be 5-2 or 4-3, but if it's the first point of the match, first game of the match, it's worth two games because it'll now take me two games to get ahead. But the reasons for the game, the reason for the game is the depth of it. And easy to pick up becomes easy to put down. Hard to pick up becomes hard to put down. And I've often said, I don't care if we'll have 100 instead of 200 players. The 100 that we have are addicted to the game for life because of the depth and the intrigue of it. And I could go into 15 reasons why traditional scoring is better than NOAAD, but I'm just on a campaign, and I will to the day I die, I'll battle to preserve 132-year heritage of traditional scoring for our children so that they fall in love with the game and the drama of it. And it's not a hokey-pokey show that needs to be over quickly. The depth is what we're missing out on. And
Luke, you're saying that. Let me ask you. Let me step in here because Coach Creasy, Luke, when he says that, you know, there in your mind, correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe in the mind of a lot of the others, the Tim Casses and all these guys, there's not going to be any game left if they don't do something to change it. You think that it's going to go away?
Whoa, JP, Dennis is going to live on a lot longer than us, and we are. It's pathetic to think that at this point in history we finally became enlightened. Now, I'm going to get off the phone here, but let me just say this. And I don't want to act like I'm angry, but a lot of times it's how things are done But the ITA and the USTA, it's disgraceful. It's disgraceful how they have pushed their agenda forward. And that should be enough to make people stand up and say, listen, you wise guys, you're not that smart, and you don't you're not very deep because you're not honoring this wonderful, wonderful game that we should be protecting. So, you know, no, it'll be around a long time. And listen, if we have a lesser audience, we have a lesser audience. But just separate education versus entertainment. That's the big thing. Thanks for letting me have all,
how,
the respect in the world there. For it.
Thanks, Coach. Same here, buddy. It's great to hear your voice.
All right, well, that was Coach Creasy. Luke, when you hear that and you see that, I mean, you know, he's not worried too much about whether or not it's entertainment or not. What happens there?
Well, listen, because, again, I love the man. I mean, he just has inspired our family and made us all better, and he makes us think. I think we can always go back, and he talked about his history. Remember, at one point, you didn't have tiebreakers. So at some point, and again, I wasn't around the game when they decided to put tiebreakers in. And there was a tiebreaker that was, remember, the nine-pointer. You played sudden death at 4-all. And if you ever really want to tick Stan Smith off, ask him the time he played Cliff Ritchie out in San Francisco at the Claremont. And it came down to a 4-all tiebreaker in the fifth or whatever set it was. It was match point for both of them. And Cliff Ritchie beat Stan Smith on a net cord winner to make the Davis Cup team or, you know, be number one in the U.S. for that year. So, you know, you could ask this, you know, the players who made changes to the scoring system then. So you didn't have sets that went to 18-16. It was 7-6. And I think there's a lot of history that we can go to and a lot of people that were there and changed those rules to look at, you know, what happened then. So I just think we have to continue to discuss and respect our history and move it forward. And it is a balance between the traditions of the game and the entertainment of the game and what funds the game. I mean, today guys are making close to $40,000 a year in the first round, losing at the U.S. Open. That's insane. McEnroe in 79 won, I think, $28,000 when he won the U.S. Open in 79. Now it's $40,000 to lose first round of singles.
The time I had Alan Fox on the show, Alan said, NOAD is the 100-meter dash.
Mm-hmm.
AD is the mile. And you look at the character of the physicality of those two events, and those two runners are very different. You look at the physique of the tennis player in 20 years, if it's all NOAD, is it going to be a different physique? Is it going to be a short time? It'll be a very different athlete and a very different person maybe who comes forward, is it?
I'll tell you, we're already seeing it. I mean, to see guys like John Isner and Sam Querrey and these guys at that height, you know, 6'10", playing from the baseline, guys could never – I mean, Milan Schraber, Victor Amaya, who was 6'7", Schraber was 6'10", I think, 6'9", 6'10". Those guys were all serving volleyers. It was unheard of to see athletes that big that would play from the baseline. But it's a baseline game now, especially on the men's side that's played with a lot of heavy topspin. It's very physical. The points are longer. But I think, again, I'm agreeing with Coach Creasy. There's, you know, a little right, a little wrong, but a lot to discuss and a lot to experiment with. And I think we just keep on, you know, moving it around to see what is the best way and keep – we're all invested. We're you know, late at night Sunday, and we're talking about it because we care. And that's the best thing.
And we do – and there are a lot of guys out there – this is sort of a political hot topic in tennis, and there are guys out there that just get totally frustrated with this, that don't want to have anything to do with this. A lot of people say, look – it doesn't matter. And maybe to a certain degree, that's the way you have to look at it as a coach. As a coach, you go on the court. It doesn't matter whether you're going to play no ad, this ad, you know, three ads, 10 ads, or whatever it is. When you go out there as a coach, you're coaching kids and they're playing – in your mind, you feel, you're pretty certain of this, it didn't matter the format, the best player or the best coached tennis player is going to win, right?
Yeah, I recent examples, I look at the Bryan brothers, and the way they run the ATP doubles now, two sets, no ad, and then a champions at 10-point tiebreaker for the third, and they're still the most dominant team over the last, what, decade or so. And to me, that would be the indicator if they weren't winning. Because you can hold serve and get hot or lucky for one game, get yourself into a tiebreaker and go. And I look at best of five sets, you know, I hear this all the time, the better player wins over the longer course of time. The best five sets, the better player should win. Well, the better players are also winning the two out of three. You still see Djokovic and Federer and, you know, until just recently, Nadal was, you know, such a dominant force in the two out of three or best of five. They're winning tons of Master Series and all those other, you know, high-profile tournaments in best of three and best of five at the Slams or Davis Cups. And you're going to get your upsets here and there, the Chiliches, the Del Potros at Slams. And those guys are extremely talented, and they get hot. But to me, it's, again, that balance. And for me, for us to be able to compete globally, we had an explosion when the Soviet Union, the wall fell, and we could get all these OVAs into the game. Now China's involved, and, you know, it's just such a global game. It's fantastic. How can we continue to develop stars and develop the game that's attractive? Again, I'm more on the entertainment side that draws eyeballs and that will, you know, create more opportunities for the federations around the world to promote tennis.
Well, I think I'm going to let you – I think we can stop with that. I think that it's actually been great. I've kept you a lot longer than I told you I would. I kept Coach Pierce on and I kept you on. And it is after all, Sunday night. So I know you probably have a lot to get done there to get ready for the week. You're at Sea Island now.
You got to walk your dog, buddy. You got to walk your dog.
I walk my dog. I got to get out. And you're at Sea Island. Now, we're going to have a high school coaches conference. I'm hoping to get you here in January. And
game on, buddy. Tell those coaches they're getting ready to work. Tell those coaches they're going to be ready to work because I'm going to work it. We're going to run them.
Sounds good. All right, well, we had Luke Jensen on. Great show, Luke. Thank you very much. And each week you can check us out here on the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. We try to at least we're going – it might not be the same time every week right now, but it's at least we're trying to find a good show. A couple of shows I want to try to get coming up. I think it's going to be very exciting for people, so tune in. And I really appreciate everyone coming on. And sorry the callers I couldn't bring on. We just had – we spent too much time listening to some of the stuff Luke had to say. So we are glad to have him on. And look forward to seeing you guys next week. And thank you very much, and this has been the We Coach Tennis Radio Show. This has been the We Coach Tennis Radio Show on the Yellow Ball Network. Check in here with us every Tuesday at noon and listen to another great coach talk about what makes their program a success.